Well, today's podcast is devoted to demonstrating the absolute reliability of the Bible that you and I are reading today, in the 21st century. And this is no trifling matter. One of the quotes that I have in a book written many years ago titled Has God Spoken is by Daniel Webster, and it's always on my mind. He said that if we abide by the principles that are taught in the Bible, our country is going to go on prospering. But if we and our posterity neglect the Bible's instructions, neglect its authority, no one can tell how sudden a catastrophe may overwhelm us and bury our glory in profound obscurity. And that's why I'm so incredibly motivated to put into your hands a documentary film called Fragments of Truth. Because in this DVD, Dr. Craig Evans and some other world-class scholars traveled the globe to track down the most ancient New Testament manuscripts. And along the way, Dr. Evans highlights groundbreaking new evidence. And this is evidence that demonstrates that God has spoken and that the Bible is divine rather than being merely human in origin. And by the way, that far from being doctored, far from pushing a theological agenda, far from misquoting Jesus, the Bible is totally, completely, utterly trustworthy. We can trust the Bibles we have in the modern era. Now, many apologists argue that the massive defection from the faith of today's younger generation is due largely to the withering attacks on the Bible by pundits and by professors and even past presidents. I think back to Barack Obama, who said that the Bible teaches slavery. The Bible teaches that eating shellfish is an abomination. If that were true, I would have problems with the Bible. So this is something that the younger generation is hearing over and over and over again through all kinds of different mediums. But I think that the assessment that these attacks are the problem misses the mark. Because the primary cause, to my mind, is that far too few Christians are equipped to debunk the claims of the critics. The contention that the Bible is human, as opposed to divine in origin, that it's the product of contaminated copies, cleverly invented stories, even of corrupt collaborators. Of course, these charges are nothing new. It's been the stock and trade of bastions of higher learning for centuries, but not today. What was once the province of private academia is now being popularized in the public arena. And while hundreds of examples are available, one stands out above the rest. And it involves the spiritual terrorism of Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman, of course, is a distinguished professor of religious studies at the prestigious University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's a professor who appears particularly proud of causing the faith of many of his students to waver. I have 12 kids, and one of my daughters, went to his school and knows firsthand how insidious the disinformation provided by Bart Ehrman actually is, because some of her friends left the faith as a direct result of listening to him speak. In fact, Ehrman has overtly said, and I have this quote right in front of me. It's a quote that I included in one of my books. Some students, he says, resist for a long time, secure in their knowledge that God would not allow any falsehoods into his sacred book. But before long, as students see more and more of the evidence, many of them find that their faith in the inerrancy in the absolute historical truthfulness of the Bible begins to waver. And so with a straight face, he tells his ever-burgeoning audience that, well, that the copyists were motivated by anti-Semitism and that the autographs themselves were well-forged. In his view, many of our cherished biblical stories, many of the widely held beliefs concerning the divinity of Jesus Christ, the Trinity, the divine origins of the Bible, stem from intentional alterations by scribes. And in the meantime, tens of thousands of people are abandoning the Christian faith because of what Ehrman and many like him are writing and what he continues to perpetually do in misrepresenting the Bible. So what's the best defense in this battle for the Bible? Well, I think it's the information beautifully depicted in Fragments of Truth. And I'm going to talk throughout this podcast, and I'm sure Dr. Craig Evans will as well, about some of the unique aspects of truth with respect to the reliability of Scripture that this DVD brings out. Well, Dr. Craig Evans is a distinguished professor of Christian origins at Houston Baptist University. He's published more than 600 articles. He's written some 70 books, and he's given lectures at Cambridge, Oxford, Yale, as well as the Field Museum in Chicago. He's been interviewed by all kinds of publications, including the Wall Street Journal. But most importantly, he is featured in this documentary DVD titled Fragments of Truth. Can we really trust the Bible? It is so wonderful to have you on Hank Unplugged, Dr. Evans.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
I want to ask you at the very beginning about the subtitle of Fragments of Truth, the DVD that I am hyperventilating over, the subtitle being, Can We Trust the Bible? Without getting into the weeds at the forefront of this discussion, what's your answer to that question?
We can trust the Bible because it's so substantially supported by historical documents, all kinds of evidence archaeologically, the manuscript evidence, this thing that I hope we do talk about called verisimilitude. In other words, the Bible tells us stories about real people, real places, real events. Historians know that. Archaeologists use it. That's a quick answer. And so the idea that the Bible can't be believed or it's full of myth or nobody trusts it is, of course, nonsense. The people that do the real work in the field dig things up and search for the past. They make use of the Bible. So if the Bible was a myth and couldn't be trusted, then what are they doing? And I'm talking about Israeli archaeologists, people from all different kinds of faith, no faith at all. They find the biblical records invaluable sources. And that simply would not be the case if the Bible, as some people say, couldn't be trusted.
You know, what's so incredible about the archaeologist Spade is that you think about some of the discoveries that are quite recent. If I've got this right in my head, in 2004, you have the discoveries of the Pool of Siloam and the Pool of Bethesda, or maybe it was just the Pool of Siloam. And when you look at the details that John gives in his gospel, you find that the descriptions that he provides match specifically with the details of what archaeology has discovered.
Well, you're absolutely right. 30 years ago, I started going to Israel. I've made it a habit since. I've gone almost every year. I've been a volunteer digger at various dig sites right there in Jerusalem. I know several archaeologists, including the one you just mentioned, Rami Arav, who has been involved in the excavation of the Pool of Siloam. And he's working at Bethsaida and other places. And I go there and I see it, and there it is. And this is the place talked about in the Gospel of John. And nobody knew exactly where it was until, as you just said, 2004. But John said it was there. And there have been many other discoveries same way. You know, we can talk about Magdala, which only recently was discovered, 2010, the actual first century Magdala, where Mary, one of Jesus' disciples, was from. We can talk about Cana of Galilee, ongoing work at Nazareth. You realize, Hank, and I know you know this, but there are some skeptics who say Nazareth didn't even exist. It's a made-up thing. Well, the name Nazareth is inscribed in stone. I mean, it just keeps piling up, and that's why I think right out of the gate, you got to say, hey, the Bible writers know what they're talking about. They're talking about real history, real people, real places, real events, and that's why historians and archaeologists make use of the biblical literature, because they find it again and again reliable.
And this is so different when you start thinking about other holy books. And I've often said that contrast is the conduit to clarity. And if you look at what archaeology has done to holy books like the Book of Mormon or the Quran, it's as though with virtually every turn of the archaeologist's spade, there's more and more evidence piled up against them. And precisely the opposite is true with the Bible. The more we dig into the dirt, the more we discover that the people, the places, and the particulars that are discussed in Scripture correspond to reality.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, we're talking about archaeology, where you unearth things, you mostly find stone and metal and that sort of thing. But we can also talk about ancient manuscripts that are discovered. I'm thinking of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I could go on for the whole program talking about how the scrolls have set the record straight. Now, we're talking about our generation. I'm talking about some scroll fragments published only in the early 90s that took a long time to come out, and they obliterated several theories that had been held in critical circles for 100 years, and these scrolls just blew them apart. And it turned out, oh, the Gospel of Matthew is correct. Oh, the Gospel of Luke is correct. Oh, guess what? Paul knew what he was talking about after all, and right on down the line. And so I tell you, my warning goes out to the skeptics. Be careful, because you're in a vacuum. What it is we don't have full knowledge about everything. We don't have all the dots sometimes that we want to connect. But as we keep digging, as we keep finding more things, and only 5% of the biblical world has been excavated, and that's mostly just partially. So it's only a fraction of what will be yielded through these researches, and they keep supporting the biblical narratives. Only a fraction of all the manuscripts, the papyri, for example, found in Egypt, only a fraction has been published so far, maybe at most 10%. And as we keep publishing and keep discovering and keep analyzing, these skeptical theories, one after another, gets knocked down, and the minimalists, the mythicists, and all these people are embarrassed. So my word to them is, hey, shut up, back up, read the text, take it seriously, and continue to follow the evidence as it unfolds.
Why are you so passionate about this particular subject? I mean, I can hear the passion in your voice.
Well, I became interested in archaeology in Israel, as I said, 30 years ago. But it was largely in response to Bart Ehrman's book that you mentioned at the top of the program, his misquoting Jesus. And I thought, wait a minute, this isn't the Bart Ehrman I remember in the 1980s. And that's when I got caught up. I had become acquainted with him, not well, but I did a sabbatical leave at Princeton. He was coming, and that was back in the 80s, and he was coming out. He hadn't gone to North Carolina yet. And I'd see him once a month, and he seemed quiet and a troubled person, not the personality you see now. And I wondered, what's going on? And then this book comes out in 05, Misquoting Jesus, and I was simply appalled. And I had become involved with him in 05 and 06 because of our involvement with the Gospel of Judas that had been discovered and finally was published. And so I read his book with interest, and I was very troubled by it, because it misrepresented and misinterpreted, misapplied the data regarding manuscripts and textual variants and scribal errors and that kind of thing. And it was very misleading and very harmful to the general reading public. And of course, you alluded to that at the beginning of this podcast. So I thought, wait a minute, this just can't be right. I began corresponding with textual critics, experts in ancient book culture, and I began my own investigations. And then coincidentally, about that time, a very important study came out by a classicist at Bart's school. The irony is really something. At the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, George Hewson, a classicist, showed that ancient literature was in existence for hundreds of years. Autographs were treasured and circulated for hundreds of years. And that got me going on something, and eventually it led to some publications and the production of this video, this movie that actually was in cinemas throughout the United States just 2 years ago, and that we call Fragments of Truth. So that's what got me into it. I wanted to set the record straight. And it's led to new discoveries, and I'm still up to my eyeballs in it. It's very exciting.
It is, and the work that you have done, particularly the presentation, the way the presentation is made in Fragments of Truth, is absolutely astounding. There are some things about this particular movie that are worth the price of admission, so to speak. We'll talk about those later, but you were mentioning Bart Ehrman, and of course I mentioned him as well. But what about his contention that the more he studied the manuscript tradition of the New Testament, the more he discovered just how radically the text had been altered at the hands of what he calls unscrupulous scribes? In other words, he's talking about the dark, sinister motives that they had. So they're not just copying the text, they're purposely changing it because they want to underscore the anti-Semitic overtones.
Yeah, that is, it's egregiously misleading. You're cherry-picking the evidence of some 5,000 documents, and you can find a handful of scribes that had a particular bias. So what? They didn't change the evidence. They didn't alter the text. That's one of the themes we explored in Fragments of Truth. The idea that an anti-Semitic element got introduced into the text and somehow survived, and it's in our Bible today, is absolutely categorically false. The idea that theology, especially Christology, got altered in one direction or another is simply false. And there are so many problems. And, you know, of course, Bart Ehrman's not alone. There are other people with less expertise, less training than Bart Ehrman has, who spout all kinds of ridiculous things, conspiracies about what books ended up in the canon, how the text may have been changed, doctrinal issues that either were introduced or suppressed. And, of course, we explore all that with the best scholars in the world. We look at the actual evidence that exists that anybody can go see and study. And, of course, we just blow these theories out of the water. There's nothing behind them. And I'm prepared to deal with any of these topics. I've explored them all. And there are a lot of good points that can be made against this silly idea that somebody tampered with the text, made some changes, altered it, and so the Bible we have today doesn't actually reflect what was originally written. That is just plain false, and we can deal with any aspect of it you want to deal with.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole idea that somehow or other you have an anti-Semitic bias in the Bible is dispelled just by common sense. And I think you alluded to that in the answer you just gave, because Christians are reminded of Jews from David to Daniel who are memorialized in Hebrews chapter 11 in the Faith Hall of Fame. We grow up as Christians with Jews as our heroes. So the very notion that the Bible somehow or other is anti-Semitic ought to be dispensed with immediately by common sense. But what about this notion that these copyists have dramatically affected essential Christian doctrine, doctrines that were codified and clarified by the seven ecumenical councils, the Christological truths of Scripture, the divinity of Jesus Christ, etc.?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, and that's something I like talking about. Part of the problem here, the backdrop, isn't just biblical illiteracy on the part of the general public as well, unfortunately, on the part of Christians themselves. Not only is it historical illiteracy, people just don't think in chronological terms. It's just appalling. And that's one of the big letdowns, in my opinion, in our public school system these days. Kids don't know history, and they don't learn to think historically either. Here's the problem immediately.
Or they learn bad history.
The problem with the idea that the text has been altered in step with theological ideas, and therefore the text that we have today might not reflect what was written, it's a gross anachronism that's going on, but the average person doesn't see it. So let me spell it out. Here's what it is. What is being suggested on the part of some of these people who think the text has been changed and new theology has been introduced or whatever, is that when scribes were copying New Testament manuscripts in the first century and then on into the second century and beyond, number one, they did not know which books would be in the New Testament. So number one, they don't know which texts need to be changed. Number two, they don't know what orthodox, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, they don't know what orthodox theology is going to be as the church's scholars get together and hammer out these questions, like exactly how do we understand the divinity or the humanity of Jesus? How exactly do we understand the Trinity? These things get hammered out at Nicaea in the fourth century and at other councils later. So how would any scribe, number one, even know what kind of change to make if he's making a copy of Romans or Matthew or Luke or whatever at the end of the first century, beginning of the second century? He doesn't have a clue what changes to make, how to make those changes. He doesn't know which books are going to be recognized finally by the church and be established as a New Testament. So you have a huge anachronism to begin with. The other thing is, Hank, this comes as a surprise to a lot of people. It's widely assumed that all of these scribes were Christians and were theologically sensitive and theologically in tune with what Christians believe. There's been a very important dissertation in Australia published just a few years ago that talks about who were these scribes that made these copies. His conclusion is they were all professional scribes, and probably only a minority of them were even Christians at all. They were professional scribes who were paid to make accurate copies. They weren't paid to be editors. They weren't paid to be exegetes or theologians. And so they had no dog in the fight. They don't necessarily even understand what they're reading. They're just simply copying the text. So the whole idea of some kind of conspiracy, whether they're anti-Semites or people with different Christological views, altering the text in one direction or another, is simply absurd on so many levels. And then, of course, my concluding argument, there isn't any evidence of that. These changes that Ehrman and others point to are later alterations in an already recognized established text. And so there really isn't any problem. That's why Bart Ehrman's own professor, Bruce Metzger, a recognized, honored professor of textual criticism, stated a long time ago that of the 20,000 lines or so that make up the New Testament, only 40 lines have any question in them at all where we're not really sure how it originally read. And by the way, we're talking about a single word almost always. And not one of those examples impact a significant Christian teaching in any way. So that's the bottom line. And Bart Ehrman, you may not know this, but in the second edition of Misquoting Jesus that he wrote, in a second edition, in an appendix, he concedes that. So it's much ado about nothing.
Yeah, it's sort of relegated to a footnote. One of the things that I love about Fragments of Truth is that you're making a point in that movie, in that DVD, in that video, you're making a point about how Jesus taught his disciples to communicate, which is he wasn't teaching them to merely parrot back what he was saying word for word. He wanted them to understand and therefore to be able to communicate in their own words what he was saying, because they were going to be sent out into all kinds of circumstances, all kinds of different cultures. So they had to really grasp these truths. So it was a matter of capturing the essential wisdom of Christ as opposed to capturing his exact words, the essential voice of Jesus as opposed to exact verbiage. And this is one of the tripping points for Bart Ehrman. He wants the four gospel writers as a case in point to say everything in exactly the same way, and if they don't, he sees contradiction.
Well, you're right on that, and he has been called out on that by me in debates, but also by others in writing, on blogs, and so on, that he's operating from a fundamentalist, a naive fundamentalist epistemology. And so even though he says, look, I don't believe anything anymore, I'm an apostate, and so on, he still reasons, he still argues, his benchmark still seems to be this kind of a naive epistemology, and you described it really well, where everything has to be exactly the same, and it's unrealistic. It reflects a later naive modern apologetic. It doesn't reflect the actual pedagogy of Jesus and his contemporaries. It doesn't reflect the actual historiography of the time under which the gospel writers operated. And so I know you're alluding to that passage in Matthew 13. Jesus has taught his disciples a series of parables relating to the kingdom. He asked them, have you understood all this? They say yes, and then it's in verse 52, Matthew 13, 52, he says, well, if they've understood it, therefore every scribe who has been trained, literally discipled, for the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who brings out of his treasure, his thesaurus, his treasure box, what is new and what is old. And what Jesus is saying here is, look, I don't want disciples who are trained parrots who simply repeat word for word what I say. I want disciples who understand what I say and can translate it into other languages, can paraphrase it, and can adapt it to other cultures, other settings, so that people anywhere in the world can understand it and learn from it.
You know, what I love about what you just said is that Bart Ehrman has, in fact, transitioned from a fundamentalist on the right to a fundamentalist on the left. And so he is trying to take biblical passages, and most particularly parables of Jesus, and he wants them to walk on all fours. It is absolutely astounding how fundamentalistic he is. Now, we want to adhere to the fundamentals, but we don't want to be fundamentalists. And he is definitely that, but as now someone who has proceeded to the far left extreme.
Well, I think you're right. And, you know, I don't want to be unfair to Bart. I know him. I'm on friendly terms with him. And we've debated publicly five times. We actually have a book coming out in the fall with Westminster John Knox Press. It's from one of our debates that we did in New Orleans. And people can see our opposing statements about whether or not the New Testament is reliable. And, you know, he's a conflicted individual. In fact, he's been challenged in debates where Dan Wallace did this one time. It was quite funny, where he said, before the debate gets underway, I have to ask Professor Ehrman, which Bart Ehrman is here tonight? The scholar who doesn't say crazy things, extreme things, or the popularizer who does this kind of extreme stuff? And everybody laughed, and even Bart himself smiled. So there is this two-side thing here. You get the fundamentalist who's responding to naive fundamentalism, people who naively think you can't have any paraphrasing. It all has to be word for word, exactly the same way. Everything has to be harmonized. And then you've got the scholarly Bart on the other side who knows, along with the rest of us scholars, that in fact it doesn't have to be that way. Jesus didn't teach his disciples to be that way.
I'm certainly glad that you're around, because a lot of scholars can't debate very well, but you not only have done the hard work that scholars have to do, but you're an incredible communicator, so I'm glad you're there to debate Bart Ehrman. Dan Wallace is another great example of someone that's very, very equipped to debate him. In Fragments of Truth, you not only demonstrate that the extant manuscripts get you very close to the original writings, but that any gap that might remain is closed by the church. In other words, by what Paul calls the pillar and the ground of truth. And that gets you very, very close, if not right back to the original writings themselves and the teachings of Jesus and the apostles.
Well, you're right, and that's why the study and the question of the longevity, that is, how long the autographs, the first copies, the original copies of Scripture, and then, of course, the immediate copies that were made, how long did they remain in circulation? Well, this has been a topic of very interesting discussion for about a decade. We're making progress. And what we've learned is that autographs in antiquity were treasured. We see this in testimonies of pagans and the testimonies of Christians. Autographs of celebrated teachers and authoritative teachers and so on were treasured and preserved. And it just so happens that these writings made of parchment or made out of papyrus, that's durable material, were able to last hundreds of years. We have solid archaeological evidence of that. We have the testimonies as well. And so this then explains the question that has been raised in the past. How was it the text of the New Testament was able to be so stable without there being a magisterium, without there being some kind of authoritative body in the church in the second century that controlled that? There was no United Bible Society in the second century. So how did the text remain so stable? And part of the answer, it isn't just, well, they respected the words of Jesus, they respected his apostles, but part of the answer is the autographs themselves remained in circulation a long time, and they were studied and compared, and that exerted a controlling factor over the preservation of the text. And I think that answers that. And that's been an exciting area of study that I'm glad I've been part of in recent years.
Oh, me too. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. In fact, I was going to talk about this a little later, but the graphical depiction of what you just said is worth the price of the DVD. It's absolutely incredible because you see that instead of manuscripts popping up here, there as individual blocks, you have whole lines that get you all the way back to the very early centuries of the church. And then you have apostolic tradition that not only gave us the Bible, but also gave us a right interpretation of the Bible. So we have not only early manuscripts, but you really can, well, tie those early manuscripts right back to the apostles and right back to Jesus Christ himself.
Well, yeah, and I think the graphics in our film are just superb and illustrate that so well. What the graphics show is, if you have most of the New Testament writings, probably all of them written in the second half of the first century, so say 50 to 100, and then if the autographs live on for 200 years or even just 150 years, that takes us all the way to the end of the second century, beginning of third century. Well, by that point, we have a substantial portion of the Greek New Testament extant. We actually have old papyrus manuscripts. You can go look at them at the Chester Beatty. You can go look at them at Oxford or Cambridge or Geneva or Rome, and that's what we did in our film. There they are. So a substantial portion of the New Testament extant today in manuscripts written when the autographs still existed, still circulated, still were studied. And of course, these papyri that you can go look at today existed when the great codices, such as Vaticanus or Sinaiticus, written in the fourth century, were produced. So there is no gap. There is no time when we just don't know, well, you know, for 100 years, there's no testimony at all. That just isn't true. And so we have this unbroken line of continuity from the original authors until the manuscripts that we have in our possession today. So that helps rule out this idea that changes that were made, and then somehow they got away with it.
Just for clarity, a lot of people listening in like flies on the wall to what we're discussing may not know the distinction between papyrus and parchment, or what a codex is, and may not understand that a lot of the parchment that we're talking about is not the same. You have lectionaries, church readings, you have uncials, minuscules. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure, that's right. What it is papyrus is a brilliant, just an amazing discovery in Egypt. That's where it flourished. They're reeds and they're cut in strips. The strips are laid out horizontally, and then a layer of strips laid out vertically on top of them. They're pressed together, and a couple of days later, you have this piece of paper. It's grainy. It's kind of a beige, light yellow color, and it's remarkably durable. After it's dried out, it remains very flexible, like modern paper. It gets rubbed, and then you're ready to write on it. Parchment is animal skin that's been stretched and also rubbed. And so those happen to be two very durable media, and that's why these documents from antiquity can last so long. We have papyri that's 3,000 years old, for example. Now, in antiquity, the papyrus pages were glued together, and then they were rolled up as a book roll or a scroll. Same with the animal skin. The famous Dead Sea Scrolls are that. They're rolled up. They're book rolls or scrolls. But also, notebooks were just single pages, sometimes pieces of wood with wax, and they were like tablets, and they were for taking notes. Christians liked that layout, and so they started making books. Now, I'm not saying Christians invented the modern book, and of course the Latin word for that is codex, but Christians popularized it. They preferred the book form as opposed to the book roll or scroll. And by the time we got to the 4th century, the entire world was using the codex, and we still use it to this day.
So let's talk about some of the manuscript fragments that are discussed in Fragments of Truth, one of them being P52, the John Rylands manuscript, a very little fragment that contains words from, I think it's John 18, right? John 18? Yeah.
Yes,
so talk about the significance of this fragment. I often talk about it as the daddy of them all.
Yeah, that's right. P52 is the papyrus number we give it for the Greek New Testament. It's 457 is the actual document number for Manchester. It's, first of all, it's a page from a book. We know that because there's writing on both sides of the page. On a book roll, you have it only on one side. So it comes from John chapter 18, and it's parts of a few verses, 31, 32, and you flip it over, and on the other side, a couple pieces of 37, 38. And, of course, it agrees with the reading that we have. So right away, it's an early witness to the stability of the text. In other words, it doesn't show some kind of wild variant that's hard to explain. The other thing it shows is, because it is so old, it just shows you, it makes that point about durability that I was just mentioning. We date this fragment. I know it's popular to say it dates to 125. That's being way too precise. It's better to just simply say it dates to the first half of the second century. When it was published in the 1930s, papyrologists had studied it, and the date range was the 90s to about the 150s, 160s. And so Colin Roberts, who published it, just, you know, said, okay, let's just go right down the middle and say 125. And so that's how it got that official date. But you need to understand, you know, you can't date anything that precisely unless there actually is a date written on it. So that's where it came from. And by the way, the controversial fragment of Mark that was early and got published 2 years ago dates to the end of the second century. So it dates to perhaps 50, 60 years of this fragment of John. And so who knows how many more early fragments we'll find. But the significance of these early fragments is they keep confirming that the text is stable. Eldon Epp, who is no conservative by any means. Eldon Epp has made the same point, a well-known, long retired now, but well-known New Testament textual critic. And he says, you know, we have now over 130 papyri of the New Testament published. And he has said, quote, there are no surprises. And that's a rather understated way of saying that the text is quite stable and the papyri support that.
I want to talk a little bit about the reverence we ought to have for these fragments. I spoke at the University of Tehran in Iran and Alma Tabetaba, the sociology university, a number of years ago. And the one thing you see there is the reverence that the Muslims have for the Quran. They would never put it on the floor, for example. They always elevate it. Oftentimes they kiss sacred objects. And I think when we're talking about fragments, some people could say, well, these are just fragments, big deal, let's move on, let's talk about something more exciting. But I think there's a reverence that we ought to have, and many people do have, for these fragments, such that we kiss them because these fragments are set apart by God as holy.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, when we interviewed John Hodgson, John is the curator for the ancient Greek manuscripts at Manchester, and he gave a very good interview, and he's in the film. You see him there. And he makes that point, how I think of course, I hear the whole interview. I hear an interview for an hour, and then we use 2 minutes of it. But I believe it's in the film where he talks about how people come and see P-52. They realize they're looking at a very old fragment of the Gospel of John. It, for all we know, it could have been copied from the original John itself. Which means if that's true, the scribe who held the pen and wrote out P-52 also held in his hand the autograph of John. In any case, he says people begin to weep. They'll actually be on their knees. They'll put their hand against the glass case in which P-52 is exhibited. They'll pray. They'll have a moment of great emotion and devotion. He finds it fascinating. And how true that is. And then, of course, in my own research, where the church fathers talk about old manuscripts, a bishop in the beginning of the 3rd century, in reference to the original of the Gospel of John, he says it's at Ephesus, and people go there to see it, and it's venerated. I find that really interesting. It's like, what's changed? The reaction to the autograph of John is essentially the same back then as it is now.
What's cool about this as you're talking is I think that when people get a sense of the significance of these fragments, they're probably going to look at their Bible in a whole new light. Rather than just taking it for granted, they're going to recognize that they have something that is absolutely extraordinary, as it were, from the hand of God himself.
Well, you know, I agree, because it's one thing for us to be theoretical. Philosophers are great for that. And all we're doing is talking about words. All we're doing is talking about something that's hypothetical, that's floating around in the air, as it were. But when you see the manuscripts, the hypothetical element recedes. You're looking at an artifact. You're looking at something that's tangible. There's no theory there. There's a fragment that people who were reading this, the older ones reading it, may well have been acquainted with apostles or acquainted with people who knew the apostles. That's how far back it goes.
Yeah.
And when you look at that, and of course I was looking at P-66, which is almost the entirety of the Gospel of John, and it's at Geneva, Switzerland. There it is right in front of me, the whole thing. And I'm staring at it, and I realized, wow, when this thing was produced, perhaps as early as 190, late 2nd century, people like Irenaeus, the great church father in southern France, who wrote his lengthy treatise against the heretics, who talked about the apostles and the writers of the New Testament, when whoever wrote P-66, these great 2nd century church fathers were still living. Tertullian of North Africa, was himself in the year 190 writing a treatise where he talks about the autographs of Paul's letters that are still available. And he names the cities. He says, you can go see them. You can go to Rome and you can see Romans. You can go to Corinth and you can see the Corinthian letters. And he talks about them. As, you know, that settles the argument. If there's some heretic out there who says, no, this is what Paul said, well, you can disprove him. You can go look at, you don't have to settle for a copy. You can look at the original that still exists. And we talk about that in the film, and I do in some of my research. And there was a time when scholars were translating Tertullian's Latin text, and they thought, can he really mean that? Should we translate this autograph? Because nobody knew 150 years ago that papyrus was so durable. It was a brand new thing that was just now beginning to be discovered. And since then, we've learned, of course, it's a durable medium. It can last thousands of years. And manuscripts in antiquity did last hundreds of years. Here's a dramatic example of that, Hank. You all know about Mount Vesuvius erupting in 79. Well, at Herculaneum, one of the cities buried under volcanic ash, was an immense library. And whoever was living in that that villa at that time tried to rescue his library, because what he left behind were 1,800 book rolls, most of them packed in boxes ready for transportation. But they didn't get away in time. And so the villa was covered with ash. The heat carbonized the book rolls, and they're still there. Now, here's where it's interesting. Our technology is such now, thanks to X-ray, MRI, and things like that, we're slowly, one by one, reading these carbonized scrolls. Hundreds of them have been analyzed now, and we're able to do what's called paleography. We can look at the style of writing, and we can date them. Well, we know when the library came to an end, it was in the year AD 79. Do you know what we've learned? Many of these book rolls, these pieces of ancient literature, they were 300 years old at the time Vesuvius erupted, and they were still being read. So we have hardcore evidence that these ancient writings lasted a long time. And so when a church father says, the Gospel of John can be viewed at Ephesus, and by that point it's over 200 years. That is not an unrealistic, silly tradition, but it's been confirmed by hardcore evidence found elsewhere in the Roman Empire.
You mentioned Irenaeus of Lyon, and I can't help but think of what he said with respect to the heretics, something you also alluded to. He talked about how they weave ropes out of sand. I mean, his language is colorful and delicious. Talk about P45. It's, as I understand it, the most ancient collection of all four Gospels. And Irenaeus, by the way, I think was the first person to ever talk about all four Gospels. I don't know if that's right or not, but I think it is.
Yes, and I believe it is right. And he's not the first to know that, of course, but he's the first to make a point out of it, because in the second century, people began writing other writings. There were people in the second century, they thought Jesus was real neat and everything, but they wished he had taught something else. They want to augment his teaching or change his teaching. And of course, now we look at them and say, hey, they're heretics, and that's what they were called by Irenaeus. And so the argument Irenaeus says is, look, guys, you know, the gospel number is growing. More and more gospels are being written. The only ones we recognize are the original four. And that's why he specifies it. It's just four. And they reach back to the apostolic period of time. They reach back to the first century. These other gospels are rather newish. Sometimes he jokes and says, you know, the ink isn't even dry yet. And what I find fascinating about that is Irenaeus and other Christian thinkers emphasize the antiquity of the tradition. And that's why the idea that the autographs and early copies that date to the first century would just be discarded and nobody would care anymore, they're getting dog-eared, they get replaced with a fresh copy, they just throw them away, that is not at all the case. These originals would have been treasured and venerated, as some church fathers actually say, even as some of the secular pagans say about writings they cherish, like autographs by Aristotle, for crying out loud. And they would be 250, 300 years old, and they were sacred and preserved. And that's what Christians did, too, in part, not just because they respected the text and wanted to preserve it, but that's how they answered the heretics. They could say, we have the originals. We have ancient copies. You don't. Your gospels, your writings are brand new, and the ink is barely dry. And so that was all part of what was going on in the second century, and I find the study of it very exciting.
P45, the most ancient collection of all four Gospels, dates back to, I think, around the beginning of the 3rd century. And when that text was copied, some of the autographs of the Gospels could well have been in circulation. So P45 could, in fact, be a witness to the originals, at least the earliest copies of the Greek New Testament Gospels.
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about it, because when P45, and by the way, it includes the book of Acts as well, when P45 was written out and then assembled, put together as a book, small book with the four Gospels and Acts, that probably took place around 200, maybe as late as 220, 240, something like that. And, of course, it's making use of other copies. Well, the copies, whoever that scribe was, the copies would date much earlier. Those copies would have gone all the way back to the time of P52, or, you know, in through there. And so it itself is a witness to the fourfold gospel and texts that would be very early. So P45, it's in the Chester Beatty Museum, Library Museum. I've been there myself, and I had the chance to just sit down and have several plates of P45 representing all four Gospels right in front of me. And it's a very neat handwriting, very delicate, neat handwriting. And as you said, it's all four Gospels, and there are no surprise readings. We're not missing a chapter here or there. We don't have inserted a new paragraph. We don't have any crazy new readings that change the theology. Nothing like that. It's the same text.
What's your thought about scholars like John A.T. Robinson and his book Redating the New Testament? He's saying that all of the books had to be written prior to the destruction of the temple in A.D. 70 because none of the books mention it. And this
I think that's a very powerful argument. Some people are impressed by it. Some people aren't real sure because we do have some writings, I'm not talking about the New Testament here, but some other kinds of writings that are after the time of 70, and they don't mention the temple's destruction. But nonetheless, I think that is a powerful argument. Take, for example, the book of Hebrews. Hebrews makes the argument that Jesus's death means that no more sacrifices are needed. Jesus is the ultimate high priest that mediates between God and humanity. Well, if the temple were destroyed, the priesthood has been ended, the altar has been knocked down, and Hebrews is being written after 70, you would think the author would, you know, it plays so well into his argument, how could he not mention it? And he doesn't. And so I think John Robinson's observation applies very well in that case. Hebrews has to be early. I would argue the same thing for James. He would have to talk about to settle questions and fears and so on. He would have to talk about the meaning of the destruction of the temple if that writing were written after 70. So I think there is a lot of merit to the late Bishop Robinson's argument that we should probably date these writings earlier. I certainly argue for earlier dates for the Gospels. I'm taking very seriously What Papias says, the elder he's talking about is the Apostle John. I know Eusebius wants to change that. That's because Eusebius in the 4th century is in a different context. He's got a Christian emperor on his side. He doesn't want to talk about Jesus returning and destroying the Roman emperor. You can see the politics get in there, and so he discredits Papias. Papias knew the Apostle John, and the Apostle John said, Peter preached, Mark wrote it down, and this becomes the source for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's what's being talked about. This is extraordinary. Early, we're talking the 50s, no later than the year 60 or 61. And so all of this stuff is early. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and the book of Acts, I think, are all earlier than 63, earlier than the great fire that destroyed half of Rome in 64.
Yeah, and the reason I bring this up is because I was just thinking about a comment that C.H. Dodd made when Bishop Robinson asked him about his book redating the New Testament. And Dodd said in response to Robinson, he said, yeah, I have to agree, a lot of the late dating that is done is arbitrary, and it's based on prejudice, the prejudice of the critics.
You know, let me add to that. I know that statement by Dodd. I greatly respect his scholarship. There is a funny thing, Hank, that goes on in the world of New Testament biblical scholarship and criticism and so on. A lot of it's insecurity. You get these young people, men and women, they're in their 20s, they have a master's degree, they're PhD students, and they're under pressure, and they end up I don't know if they even are conscious of it, playing the game of, I'm every bit as critical as you are, or I'm more critical than you are. And criticism and skepticism get confused. Skepticism is one thing, criticism is something else. I'm all for criticism, but there's a lot of skepticism out there that's uncritical. And so just saying, I don't think Paul wrote that letter, that's not necessarily critical. To insist that a gospel is written late. I mean, there are scholars who are suggesting the Gospel of Luke didn't get written until the 2nd century. I have a commentary on Acts in a prestigious series, and the author who died recently said, Acts wasn't written until 120. This is getting absurd. We're making dates that are so late, they're getting later than some church traditions talk about them. It doesn't make any sense. And it's a hyper-skepticism. It really isn't a criticism. It's not being critical. And I think you're right. And so one of the things to do is to deny traditional authorship or, and it goes hand in hand, argue for real late dates, and somehow that makes you more critical. I don't think so for a minute.
I want to talk a little bit about internal evidence that undergirds the absolute reliability of the biblical text. I'm talking about the actual testimony of the authors who were eyewitnesses. For example, the famous saying of the Apostle John when he said, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. So you have autographs that are preserved in manuscript copies, but that's a preservation of what was communicated by those who were eyewitnesses to the majesty of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know that one is very, very powerful. And of course, I think part of the problem with 1 John is that a tradition of scholarship developed, and I'm not going to blame liberals or skeptics for this, because there were evangelical scholars who saw it this way too. The idea that the Johannine letters, and you just quoted the beginning of 1 John, had to do with Gnosticism. And because it supposedly had to do with Gnosticism, this started dating it really late. So this is some kind of reaction to Gnostics who in the 2nd century were changing things and saying, oh, yeah, you know, the Christ has come, but he really wasn't in flesh. And you get this docetic idea that you know, if you look carefully at Jesus, you realize you could actually see through him. He was more of a phantom. I don't think 1 John has anything to do with that. 1 John is connected to the Gospel of John. The allusions are obvious that ties that first letter with the Gospel. And what we're talking about is a response to the synagogue. And it's very early. It's not second century. The synagogue that is beginning to say, perhaps after 70, but maybe even before, as one other scholar has recently argued, as early as the 60s, the synagogue is saying, hey, we don't think Jesus really is the Messiah. We don't think the Messiah has yet come. And that's what is meant by the Messiah hasn't come in the flesh. It's not docetic. It's not a thrust against Gnosticism. It's simply a statement that the Messiah hasn't yet come. Not really. And so 1 John is saying, are you kidding? We've seen the Messiah. We've touched him. The word of life has come in flesh. And so if we understand that, we realize, wait a minute, 1 John is earlier than we realized, has nothing to do with Gnosticism. It's instead defending the reality of Jesus' appearance as the Messiah in the context, a polemical context, with the synagogue that says no, which means this is very early apostolic tradition. It is eyewitness tradition.
And that's something I'd like to park on for a long time, but I don't think time permits. Let's move quickly to external evidence and maybe a bit of a discussion about how significant it is that from external evidence, it's possible to piece together highlights of the life of Christ wholly apart from the Bible. So you have cooperating testimony coming, in some cases, from people who were huge critics, not only of the Bible, but of Christians. And if you had adhered to a Christian worldview and you got into the pathway of Plinius, for example, you might well either recant or die.
Well, yeah. I've done some work on that very tradition in Plinius the Younger. He's a troubleshooter. He's a governor of Bithynia, and Trajan is the emperor, and I think it's just fascinating. And of course, if you know the context, you can read his letter. When he says he interrogates the Christians, Roman interrogation usually involved a whip, and so, you know, the innocent ones get away with the whipping. The guilty ones end up being executed or imprisoned. And then he says something like, well, all they do is get together before daybreak. Well, right away we know these are slaves. The only time they can meet is before their masters wake up and expect breakfast and so forth. Then it goes on to say they sing a song antiphonally back and forth to somebody called Christ as though he's a god. And then they promise, take vows not to embezzle property entrusted to them. That confirms that we are talking about slaves. And then they go on to say that they have a meal, and Plinius says, an innocent one. I find that fascinating because what that is, and we're talking about a guy who's writing around the year 110 AD, the allegation that Christians were cannibals. And of course, it's the words of institution. This is my body. This is my blood. You know, this is for you. Take, eat, you know, and so on. And so the Greco-Roman world was hearing lies about Christians told by critics saying that Christians were cannibals. And when you combine that with Christians' compassion for children who were cast out as unwanted infants, then you can see where that goes. So, oh, yeah, Christians, sure, they rescue unwanted infants. They're mostly girls thrown out. The Christians rescue them, and then, of course, in their weird cultic meals, they cook and eat these infants and so on. And, you know, the church has to defend itself. Even Tertullian, at the end of the second century, is still defending the church against that kind of charge.
Yeah, so the external evidence, absolutely incredible that you can piece together highlights of the life of Christ, even apart from the Bible, when you go to these kinds of writers, these historians. Josephus is a classic case in point, Tacitus and Suetonius, and the list goes on. But I want to talk about the science of textual criticism and how you go about dating manuscripts to begin with.
Well, you can date a manuscript in several different ways. Sometimes we have manuscripts that simply have a date written on them, and that's very handy. And so there it is. It's the third year of the reign of Emperor Augustus, and you have a month and a day, and you can date it precisely, and like modern correspondence. And, of course, that's what it usually is. It's correspondence. It's what we call it's documentary evidence, business papers, contracts, deeds, IOUs, receipts, personal letters, business letters, and so forth. The problem is literature. And so it's a romance novel. It's a philosophical treatise. It's a gospel. It's one of Paul's letters or something like that. And they don't have dates. And so these things get copied and copied again, and then we wonder, when was it originally written? We just don't know. There is no date that tells us. And so how do you then date a document that you find? Like we've been talking about P45, the four Gospels and Acts. We've been, we've been talking about it as, beginning of the third century. How do we know that? So there are two ways of dating a document that way, where we don't really have a context. We don't know where it was found other than it was in Egypt someplace. And so you can date it with carbon-14. And carbon-14 gives you a plus or minus usually of about a half century. And that's not real helpful. It gets you into the ballpark. And so P45, if you test it with carbon-14, it could be as early as 150, and it could be as late as 250, 260. So that's what it will do. The other thing, though, Hank, when you do a carbon-14, you're actually dating the papyrus. You don't know how old the papyrus was, though, when the scribe wrote. And so the papyrus could be 20, 30 years old. Sometimes they're reused and second time. So that you have to be careful and know what it is you're dating, not necessarily the writing, but just the paper itself. And the other way of dating it is the handwriting, the style of handwriting, which I alluded earlier about the charred book rolls at Herculaneum. So handwriting styles, every generation change a little bit. And so those two ways of dating it usually gets us in a ballpark, and that's why we can say things like P45 dates to the first half of the third century, or P52 dates to the first half of the second century, and things like that.
There are a couple of phrases here that might be good to unpack. If I talk about a textual variant, what am I talking about? And then perhaps as well, how frequent are textual variants? And if it were true, as Bart Ehrman says, that there are more mistakes than there are words in the New Testament in these copies, in these manuscripts, how big a deal is that to begin with?
Yeah, that, of course, is one of his most misleading comments. It is true, and it's true only because we have 5,000, and more manuscripts. These are all handwritten manuscripts, and let me use P66 as an example. That's the almost complete copy of the Gospel of John. It's kept at the Bodmer Library in Geneva, Switzerland. Well, there are over 400 mistakes made in that manuscript where the scribe, as he's writing it, writes the wrong word, or he simply leaves out a word. Then, after he finished writing it, he very carefully proofreads it and corrects them all. Well, that bumps up the variant count, but when you stop and think about it, how many real variants are there? He's made over 400 mistakes. He proofreads his own work. He catches most of them and corrects them. And so it just depends on how you measure it. And some people insist every time you see a word that's crossed out or something written in the margin, that counts as a scribal error, or it counts perhaps as a variant. So counting these becomes rather tricky. But a true variant is where you simply have a different reading. And so you have most manuscripts read a certain way, but then you have one or two that read maybe differently. There's a single word difference. Sometimes it's just the definite article that's either in front of a name. Like, a lot of people don't realize that, but when you see Jesus in the Greek text, it often has the definite article the in front of it. Some manuscripts have it, some don't. Whether it's there or not, it makes absolutely no difference how you translate it or how you interpret it. So how you count these variants, it varies. But also the fact that we have, you know, a complete Greek New Testament's about 500 pages. And so it's nothing to have one variant or one mistake on each page. So each manuscript's going to have about 500. And then you have 5,000 of these, give or take, or complete New Testaments, about 3,500. Well, you can see how that number quickly multiplies. So it's mixing apples and oranges to make a little quip like that and say why there are more mistakes or more variants than there are words. And I mean, Bart really knows how to communicate. He's been trained in debate. He is a formidable debater. He's tricky. If his opponent doesn't know his stuff, he'll take advantage of him. When I debated him the first time, he tried pulling that on me a few times. It didn't work, and the debates were a little different after that. But he'd throw out stuff that I knew was factually incorrect, and I'd catch him on it. He'd smirk, and the debate would continue. So this is one of the most egregious, misleading statements he makes. So yeah, it's true, mathematically, the numbers aren't wrong, but it's highly misleading if it's not explained to the non-expert what those numbers really mean.
Another word that is used in Fragments of Truth, but not only used but explained in a way that I'd never heard it before, is the word autograph. And the fact that an autograph doesn't mean that you just have one copy, but that in many cases you have at least two copies and maybe more. So talk about what an autograph is, the etymology of the word.
Yeah, and actually the Greeks have several words that can be translated autograph. The word autograph is a Greek word. It literally means written by himself or written itself. It means I am the author and I have written it in my own hand. Of course, what it comes to mean is I am the author and I've dictated it to a scribe. He's written it. He then hands me the pen and I sign my name at the end of it. And so that's what the word autograph comes to mean. Now, by the way, there are at least two other words that mean the same thing. So when we speak of the autograph, like, for example, let's talk about Paul. He writes a letter to the Romans. He likely held the pen only at the end to sign his own name. That's what he typically does in his letters. He'll sometimes say that, I, Paul, write this in my own hand. Look how big my letters are, you know, something like that. And so Paul is not a professional scribe. He's literate. He can read. He can write, but he's not a professional scribe. And writing neatly on papyrus is not easy. So he hires a scribe who writes out the letter of Romans, and it's probably been drafted, and so it's a carefully prepared text. It's dictated to the scribe. He writes it out. Paul signs his name, and then a second copy is made. And the signed copy is sent to Rome. The second copy is retained, and that's why I say in Fragments of Truth, we should assume that every single writing of the New Testament had two originals, at least. But some of these writings are circular letters. Ephesians is a good example of that. It's likely that Paul had half a dozen copies made and circulated. So we don't have just one autograph. We've got five or six. James, probably the same. Some of the Gospels, perhaps that way too. Do we have proof of this? We do. We know this from the letters that have been found at Oxyrhynchus in Egypt. We know that there were multiple copies. At Qumran, a letter that spells out what the phrase works of the law means. That's a very fascinating letter. There are six copies of it at Qumran. So we know the idea of multiple copies that circulate is a reality in antiquity. So if you have two or more originals for each writing, the chances of survival for 100 years or 200 years, those chances go way up. And again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning of the program. This is why the text is stable. We have the old copies, the original copies existing a long time, and people study them. And we know that because this is talked about, not just by church fathers, but also pagans who talk about their pagan writings. They get a hold of an original. They want to check it and see what is the original writing. That's important to them. The idea that ancient people were stupid or careless, and they honestly didn't care how it originally read, they were academically or intellectually lazy, that's condescension on our part. I've seen these writings. These people were smart. They would write marginal notes. They would do careful thinking. They engaged in what we call textual criticism. They did back then. And the idea that they would accept a poor reading, I mean, the early New Testament scribes, if they got a manuscript and they read it carefully and suspected there was a mistake, they checked and got it corrected. We see numerous examples of that. And so the idea that the manuscripts were handled carelessly, that all kinds of changes were made, that we now don't really know what Paul said in Romans or what Jesus said in Matthew, there is no basis for saying that, none whatsoever.
We've mentioned the term textual criticism or the science of textual criticism a number of times in this podcast. Give us a short definition for people that are not familiar with the discipline.
Textual criticism just simply means a careful study of the manuscripts to determine that the text before us is the original. And especially if we're talking about handwritten manuscripts, you know, we realize that, you know, all of us write, and so you always can make a mistake. I pick up the pen and I start writing, and oops, I've written the wrong word, I cross it out. But that's what textual criticism is. It's just looking at the manuscripts, comparing them, and making sure that the text before us is, in fact, what the author originally wrote.
How do we know that the four Gospels that we have in our Bibles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Synoptics and John, how do we know they were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Well, I think we know that, number one, the obvious thing is not one alternate author has ever been suggested. I think that's very, I know you might think, well, that's just an argument from science, but, you know, there was a lot of debate about Gospels, especially in the second century when new Gospels began to be written. And the fake Gospels that come along, like the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, and so on, and it's quite a list, and these all start popping up like mushrooms in the second century. They all claim apostolic authorship explicitly in the text. For example, Thomas says, these are the secret words which Jesus spoke and which Judas Didymus Thomas, Judas Thomas the twin, wrote down. And so, like the fragmentary Gospel of Peter, in it, it'll say, I, Peter. You know, it's in the text. So you get this consciousness on these new Gospels as they're being written. They need to identify themselves. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't do that. And never does anyone say they were written by anyone else. I deduce from that, others do too, that the authorship of the four Gospels in the New Testament was recognized from the get-go. Everybody knew Matthew wrote Matthew, Mark wrote Mark, and so forth. And so, and they knew that not because the writers had to embed their names somewhere in the document itself, but they knew it. And so what's lost, Hank, is that the original letter that went along with it. So when Matthew originally circulated, there likely would have been a letter, a preface of some kind, a foreword that accompanied it. And this is probably true for all of them. That's lost. It's only the Gospel of Matthew that keeps getting copied. And so let me give you another example of this. The one book in the New Testament that's prominent and is anonymous is Hebrews. And so we don't know who wrote Hebrews, and the early church didn't know. Well, guess what? You have half a dozen different suggestions that are made. Some people saying, oh, it must have been Tertullian. No, it must have been Apollos. No, it must have been Paul. No, it could have been Barnabas. You get all these different suggestions that are made. You don't have anything like that for Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, or Acts. And I think that argues strongly against the idea that the Gospels circulated anonymously. Nobody really knew who wrote them. If that were true, if Matthew, Mark, Luke, John began to circulate in the first century anonymously, then we would have half a dozen suggestions for each one of them. But that is just not the case.
Talk about the word gloss, and then I want to get into some of the glosses, and perhaps we can go through them in sequence, maybe two or three or whatever. But what's a gloss?
A gloss is typically a scribe is making a copy. Or it's not a scribe, it's a preacher or a theologian who has the text in front of him and he's preparing his own notes. And he looks at a text and, for example, he sees an Aramaic word. And so he goes, oh, this is a transliteration of something Jesus said in Aramaic. And so he scribbles in the margin the Greek translation because it's going to help him or a later reader. That's a gloss. And sometimes these glosses creep into the text. So that's all that a gloss means. It's often just a brief explanation, a translation to help out a reader.
So one of those glosses might be identified as the Comma Johannium. And I think that's a particularly interesting one because here you have a scribal insertion, or at least it seems, that is in the text in order to demonstrate that the Trinity is actually something that the author was driving at. So to kind of help the author along by actually putting the Trinity in there overtly when it really doesn't belong in there to begin with.
Yep, you're right. And this one is particularly interesting because we suspect the gloss began in the Latin tradition. And so in the early Middle Ages, a Latin scholar, preacher, you know, theologian, whatever, scribbles this gloss in a margin explaining the meaning of the blood and the water and all this witness, this testimony, and so on. Somebody then theologizes it in an overt Trinitarian direction. Someone else then just pulls it right into the text. And then a later scribe who is doing a Greek version of the New Testament pulls the Latin. He's bilingual. He knows Greek and Latin fluently. And he brings the Latin reading into the Greek. And that's why Erasmus, when he prepared the first edition of the Greek New Testament in 1516, that's why it was to his credit to resist adding that expansion in 1 John 5, 7, and 8. He didn't want to do that because he could tell from the Greek manuscript tradition that was very poorly attested. In fact, he didn't find one example of it.
Another example that might be given is the long ending of Mark. What is your perspective? I've been asked that question for over 30 years in the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Yeah. What about the long ending of Mark? It seems like that's a gratuitous addition to a gospel that wouldn't end well otherwise.
Yeah, I know, and what you just said could well be correct. I got to admit, my mind is unmade up on that. I find it mysterious that both Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, they're both 4th century, when they come to Mark 16, verse 8, there's a long blank that follows. And both of them do that. So on the one hand, yes, they both end at 16:8, for they were afraid. But then they don't start up the next gospel right away. They leave this long, this big blank section. It's as though they know that there should be something else, but I don't have a manuscript at hand that has it. Now, here's what else we have. Irenaeus is familiar with one or two of the verses that we find in later manuscripts that have Mark 16, verses 9 through 20. So some of Mark's ending seems to be known in the second century, and yet in these two fourth century beautiful manuscripts that are excellently constructed and well made. There's nothing. It's just, it ends at 16:8. So that's a little puzzling to me. So here's my theory, and it's just a theory. My theory is there was more of an ending to Mark. It didn't stop at verse 8. Or if it did, somebody very early on added more of an ending. But it just didn't take hold until a much later time. And so the ending we now have, verses 9 through 20, is an approximation and probably an expansion of what would have been a briefer ending. Robert Gundry argues for that too. He thinks that Matthew's gospel, Matthew would have been familiar with Mark, he thinks Matthew's ending contains part of, maybe even all of, Mark's original ending. That's not a very satisfactory answer to your question, but that just shows you that is the one text critical issue for the entire New Testament that is really puzzling and remains today largely unresolved.
So I'm Greek Orthodox, and one of the arguments that the Orthodox would make is that you have a tradition that not only gives us the Bible, but gives us a right interpretation of the Bible, and in addition to that, lets us know what the Bible is to begin with. So, for example, you have the writings of Christ and the apostles. You then have the apostolic fathers, you have the holy fathers, and eventually you have this word getting out to every Eucharistic assembly throughout the land. And that tradition gives us an idea of how Mark should have ended, and therefore the ancient church always adds the extra verses. They may make a notation that not contained in the earliest and best authoritative manuscripts, but since the fathers gave us this as inspired scripture, we're to take it as inspired scripture.
I'm a supporter of that view. Textual criticism is always interested in what is the original reading. That's one thing. The final canonical authoritative reading might not be the same thing. And I think with some strict fundamentalist Protestant thinking, they want to say it's the same thing. They want to say that it's the, you know, it's Paul's original autographic Romans. That's authoritative. And sometimes I think it is. But I think we do need to be open to the idea that, you know, the second century church fathers play a role. After all, in the fourth century, we've got the Nicene Council and the Nicene Creed, and that's considered orthodoxy. So if you can hammer out Christology in the fourth century, and you can hammer out and finalize the canon of Scripture in the fourth and fifth centuries, why can't you, in a sense, hammer out the text also in a later time, which means that a later authoritative text might be 99% the same as the original, but it isn't necessarily 100% the same. That's a theological question, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate question. Sometimes for students, I put it this way. Look, I've published a bunch of books, and I always submit an autograph. Of course, we email it now as an attachment, and I send it to my publisher, and there it is. I'm so glad they never publish it. They never publish the autograph. It's a copy editor. It's somebody. I've published, I think, two or three essays in the Christian Research Journal for you. I'm always glad that a copy editor goes over it, not only correcting some typos, but tightening it up, making it read a little better, asking me perhaps to change this or that. So what gets published is 95% what I submitted, but it's a little bit better, actually. So I throw that out to students sometimes, and I think the Apostle Paul would feel the same way. If he found out that there were a couple of confusing things in Romans that he sent to the church at Rome, and some sharp-minded scribes reacting to Paul's other letters tightened up the argument and made the point slightly better here or there in a couple of verses, why would Paul object?
Love it. A couple more. The longer ending to the Lord's Prayer. I mean, I always find this fascinating because in our church, the priest always finishes the prayer. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. If you actually look at the text in modern Bibles, you don't have that longer ending. You have, for if you forgive men when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you don't forgive men their sins, your Father in heaven will not forgive your sins. What about that longer ending, which comes from the Old Testament, 1 Chronicles 29, I think?
Well, it comes, as you just said, from 1 Chronicles. So you've got a gloss inspired by a biblical benediction that gives a beautiful ending to the longer version of the Lord's Prayer as it is in Matthew, because, you know, as you know, the Luke's version is shorter still. I don't see any problem with that. It goes to what we were just talking about. We might agree that the original Matthew that circulated in the first century had a shorter version of the Lord's Prayer. It gets expanded sometime in the second, maybe third century, maybe even later. And in the church liturgy and the lections, the church prefers the longer version. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, perfect answer. I couldn't agree more. What about the insertion in biblical texts, which again, in the ancient church's view, belongs there? In other words, it's scripture. It's considered scripture, even though a notation is made in many of the Orthodox Bibles with respect to this woman caught in adultery.
Yeah, of course. That's a great story. Johannine scholars and historical Jesus scholars will talk about it and say, you know, there's a good chance that it's an authentic story from the life of Jesus, and therefore it's an example of what's called an agraphon. That is a tradition, it's usually just a saying, but in this case it's a whole story, originally not written. And that's what agraphon means, not written in the Gospels. And then later on, it finds itself written somewhere else, in this case in a gospel, the Gospel of John. And so I think, you know, don't underestimate the intelligence of people. When I teach, that's what I tell them. I say, you know, this is a good chance. It's an authentic story from the life of Jesus, but it probably did not originate in the Gospel of John and not in chapter 7 where it currently is located. In some Greek New Testaments, it's in Luke. In some Greek New Testaments, it's in different locations in John 7. So you just tell them the facts. So it could well be an authentic story. It definitely is consistent with the behavior and mercy of the historical Jesus. So it has the ring of authenticity, even though textually it originally wasn't part of the Gospel of John. And you know what? I find people don't have any problem with that. In fact, they're glad to hear that.
Yeah, one of the reasons I bring this up is because Paul calls the church the ground and the pillar of truth. And so we can have some confidence of the Holy Spirit working through the church to not only give us our Bibles. The Bible wasn't formally codified until 367 by St. Athanasius, but also to give us a sense of what should or should not be included in the biblical text, what we should or should not take seriously. And I think the same thing goes with respect to the longer canon, talking about the Old Testament. The ancient church said, well, you know, this is part of the Septuagint, and therefore, because it is part of the Septuagint, and Jesus Christ quoted the Septuagint, therefore, we can include these books in the longer canon of the Old Testament, even though we're not going to make dogma on the basis of those books.
Yep. I don't have any problem with that. The early church, for example, will make this distinction. I have co-authored a book with Lee MacDonald, who is well known for studies on the canon, and John Collins, and it's coming out with Westminster John Knox Press also. And so it's rather fresh in my mind, but my assignment was to talk about the books that were left out of the New Testament, And why is that? And so I have a couple of chapters, one general on that theme, and then one chapter specializing on the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Thomas. And it's really interesting, in some of the canon lists, you'll hear a comment like, oh, this writing is okay to personally read and study, but it shouldn't be read in the church. And that's an interesting distinction. And in this case, it was in reference to the Shepherd of Hermas. And I believe that may even be said about the Didache. And so these writings were considered very good, wholesome, healthy, edifying writings, but not on an apostolic or dominical level. And so, no, we're not going to read them in church. And if we're not going to read them in church, they're not going to form the basis of our doctrine. But we're not going to prohibit them. They're not banned. You can read them. And so there was a sensible, pragmatic attitude, and that was the attitude towards some of these books that we call Apocrypha. Catholics don't call them Apocrypha, call them Deuterocanonical. And I tell my students the same thing. Hey, read 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. You're going to learn a whole lot. Read Tobit and Judith. You'll learn a whole lot about Jewish piety in the 1st and 2nd centuries B.C., even if you shouldn't take them to the historical bank, because that's another story. But the writings do have value, even if we're not going to build our theology on them.
A couple more points of discussion. Why do you say that throughout the whole of history, there's never been an individual who's been in a position to make a deliberate, substantial change across the New Testament?
Well, of course, an individual, that's only half of what I said. There's an individual who's, you know, anybody can make a change. The issue is, will he get away with it? And so there was no scribe. Pete Williams made this case. So did Simon Gathercall, both of them in our documentary Fragments of Truth. They made the case that it would be impossible if some scribe in one particular place, say Alexandria, Egypt, decides to improve on the Gospel of John and change it. Well, that's not going to affect all of the other copies elsewhere, nor is it going to impact the copies of Greek John being translated into Latin. So you got two different languages at least in the second century, several different regions. That's why we say there is no one guy with a new idea that wants to make a change who could possibly get away with it, make it happen. It just isn't possible.
Yeah, one other quick question that has to do with the popular myth that the Emperor Constantine in the 4th century, in conjunction with the Council of Nicaea, picked the books that were going to be in the New Testament canon.
Yeah, had he done that, that would have been hugely controversial. You would have had all kinds of comments about that in Eusebius's church history, because he had editions before 325 and an edition after. And he talks about what books ought to be in the canon. He has his own personal views. And if Constantine had chosen the Gospels, as Dan Brown says, or Dan Brown very confusingly has his character, Sir Lee Teabing, say that Constantine collated the New Testament, whatever that means, you would have had all kinds of controversies. No, that wasn't the concern. Two things you can say. Constantine wanted the church to get together and get on the same page, number one. Just, this was their first chance, legalized now. It's okay to be a Christian. Let's get together and hammer out what it is you believe. And then the focus, number two, is what do you believe about Jesus? It's focused on Christology. And that's exactly what the church did, and we ended up with the Nicene Creed. This idea that Constantine influenced which books would be in the New Testament, or more specifically, which of the Gospels would be chosen, is absurd. Or the idea that he wanted the Gospels to be chosen where Jesus is more divine and less human, that flies in the face. The Gnostic Gospels deny Jesus' humanity and exaggerate the divinity. So this idea is wrong on many levels.
And as you're speaking, I was thinking about the fact that I wrote a book along with Dr. Paul Meyer called the Da Vinci Code, fact or fiction, in order to debunk the nonsense that was being communicated very popularly by Dan Brown. One last question. I can't resist asking you this question because it had such a deep impact on my own writing many, many years ago. And that is the insights from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Melchizedek Scroll, for example, indicating that Melchizedek is God himself. When I read your writings on this, it was like an epiphany for me.
Yeah, same here. I went to Claremont for my PhD, and I had the privilege of studying with both the late William Brownlee, who was in Israel in 1947-48 when the Cave 1 discoveries were made. So he was one of the very first scholars to see the scrolls. What a privilege to study with him. But I also studied with Jim Sanders, still living, 92 years old, who published the first volume on the Psalm Scroll from Qumran. And what a privilege to be there. And boy, my eyes about popped out. It hadn't been published that long, 11Q13, that is the Melchizedek fragmentary scroll from Cave 11. And it was just mind-blowing. There you are, Isaiah is being quoted to declare the acceptable day of, and in the Hebrew text, it's Yahweh, the acceptable day of Yahweh. But in the Melchizedek scroll, the name Melchizedek is in place of Yahweh. And then he goes on to talk about him seated in the heavenlies among the gods, having great authority and so on. He forgives sin. He can defeat Satan. And I'm wondering, what in the world? You know, and then I realized, no wonder the author of Hebrews compares Jesus to Melchizedek. That doesn't mean the author of Hebrews had read the Melchizedek scroll, but that had to be an interpretation that was known. So it just shows you that the Jewish people were very open to the idea of a Savior who would come, who in some sense was God himself, able to defeat Satan, rescue Israel, and forgive Israel of its sins. And in my belief, that person did come, and that was Jesus of Nazareth.
Absolutely. As we close out this podcast, a couple of things. One is Fragments of Truth. Can we trust the Bible? Available for those who support the ministry outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, including our podcast, our broadcast, our 24/7 outreaches around the world. This DVD, this movie, is available to you for your support. Check it out on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Also, if you love Hank Unplugged, make sure you rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you're using. And lots of five-star ratings are propelling the podcast to people and places I could have scarcely imagined. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And also, I think listening in to my discussion with Dr. Craig Evans, I've made good on the promise once again that I am bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet direct to your earbuds. So thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. And you can check out all of these podcasts on the web at equip.org and, of course, wherever podcasts are disseminated. So check out the other podcasts. After you've listened to this podcast, you're going to find some of the other interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet and their commentaries on some of the most significant subjects in our era. Dr. Craig Evans, I am deeply grateful for not only your time, but also for your passion for the contributions that you are making. You are definitely a treasure to the Christian community and beyond.
Thank you very much, Hank. I appreciate that.
You got it. And again, Hank Unplugged, you can find it on the web at equip.org, and Fragments of Truth, available for those who support our ministry. Thanks for tuning in. So long for now.